Tonight on Arena, how 20th century classical music shaped pop, Tygo Sullivan tells us about his new feature film and new Irish photography at the RHA. You can text us, of course, on 51551, email arena at rte.ie, and we are on Instagram at rte_arena. That might be handy for that third item we're coming to a little bit later on. We'll be putting up some of the photographs we'll be talking about. Tonight, we begin with the presenter of BBC Radio 3's Classical Live and Unclassified. Elizabeth Alker joined the BBC as a rock and pop journalist working for Radio 6. The daughter of classically trained parents, Elizabeth quickly began to identify the points of confluence between pop and classical music, and the result is her book Everything We Do Is Music: How 20th Century Classical Music Shaped Pop. And Elizabeth joins us now. Welcome to Arena, Elizabeth.
Hello, thank you for having me.
When we talk about 20th century classical music, we're talking about a music, and you say this very early on in the book, that took a wrecking ball to canonical thinking. So take us back to the early decades of the 20th century and maybe just put this new form of classical music in context for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, as you say, to kind of go back to the early decades of the 20th century, the First and Second World War play a huge role in this. They're big characters in this book, if you like. And this was a time, as is often the case during, you know, moments of international conflicts and that sort of thing, of a really extraordinary rate of technological advancement, and mostly in terms of communications technology for propaganda broadcasts and communications on the battlefield. And so these radio studios and communications organisations were popping up all over Europe with these new gadgets. And the tape machine was a gadget that kind of developed, you know, an incredible rate during this time. And I guess, you know, now classical composers, they'll go still into somewhere like, well, Ada Vale is where the BBC Symphony Orchestra used to be based, or similar studios around Europe, to work with an orchestra to write classical music, orchestral music. And they were doing that at this point after the war, but finding these gadgets and finding these tape machines and finding that they could record sounds and make music electronically. And that was really one of the starting points for, you know, an entirely new kind of sonic kind of tableau for classical music, really. These tape recorded sounds and compositions that were made by layering and mixing and looping and reversing sounds and building them up into these sonic tapestries, I suppose.
And this is all in the context of classical music taking enormous leaps in the kind of early to mid 1910s. I mean, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring happens then. Schoenberg is writing music. It was a time when classical music changed forever as well.
Yeah, and classical composers were trying to reflect the times and reflect what they were seeing and modernity. And, you know, you mentioned Schoenberg. So, you know, psychoanalysis and that kind of thing were, you know, influencing the way people thought and thought about themselves and, you know, were kind of feeling about the way they interacted with the world as well. And these composers wanted to reflect that. And there was more technology in society, you know, railways and, you know, there was industry and gadgets at home and that kind of thing. And I suppose musicians, they wanted to reflect what they could hear around them. So one of the stories that I tell in the book is about Leon Theremin, who was a Russian spy. And he was working for Lenin in Russian espionage, and he developed the theremin it's quite a well-known story, this, but, you know, he actually was working to develop a listening device to be planted in the American embassy to spy on the Americans. And he was working with electromagnetic fields and realised that when he put his hands near to this device, it whistled. And because he had a background in classical cello performance, the musician was kind of awoken in him, and he realised he could play these sounds. People thought he was a magician. He was sent all around the world, you know, telling, you know, people about this incredible instrument. And that was another, you know, it was one of the first electronic instruments, if you like. So, and the composers wanted to work with him because they heard these sounds and it felt like the world around them. So yeah, it was really, like you say, it was all happening around that time.
I'm interested in talking about, and I'm going to use a phrase that maybe a lot of people listening may not necessarily be familiar with, and to be honest with you, I only know it because I came across a playlist on Spotify about 4 years ago, Music Concrete.
Yes.
Some of the early innovators dubbed it that. Explain that term to us and maybe tell us a little bit about Pierre Schaeffer and Pierre Henry, combining what they like to think of as art and science together in a new form of music.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they were two Parisian composers working in a radio studio originally in Paris, which had been set up, like I say, for propaganda purposes initially. And the term concrete, it refers to music existing on tape. So it had a concrete property now. You know, it wasn't just notes kind of written down that then a musician could interpret and play however they wanted, really. Like now the composer controlled the entire sound and composition and feel of the composition, and it wasn't left to the musician's interpretation. So it had this kind of concrete property. It existed on tape. And they were recording sounds. Pierre Henry was trained as a classical musician and composer. And Pierre Schaeffer was a composer. He was also an engineer, and he'd kind of come through studio training. But they were working with tape machines. They were recording natural sounds or found sounds, the sounds of trains, heavy industry, also, you know, sounds in nature, so bird song and that kind of thing. And then once the sound is recorded onto tape, you can use the machine to slow it right down or to play it backwards or to speed it up. And I guess once you've, you know, say like the sound of a person laughing, if you speed that up, it has this psychedelic quality. And that was a big influence on the psychedelic rock bands of the 1960s, particularly in the UK. So they were, you know, they're little known but hugely influential composers working in Paris just after the war.
Yeah, I'm going to take the jump forward here now that you've mentioned that, because we're going to play the Beatles' Tomorrow Never Knows in a minute, which is one of my favourite Beatles songs. But to the untutored ear, it might seem that it's as far as music can get from classical composition. Tell us a little bit about the influence in particular of Delia Derbyshire, the great Delia Derbyshire, on the Beatles' development at that stage.
Yeah, well, for the book, I got to interview Paul McCartney, and he told me about I think a lot of people think that the person who introduced the Beatles to a lot of this kind of avant-garde influence was John Lennon, but actually Paul McCartney was the only Beatle in the sort of mid to later 60s living in London, and he was going around and he was just absorbing all these influences. And London was quite uniquely placed because there was lots of American rock and roll, but there were also these avant-garde influences coming from the continent as well. And he saw composers like Stockhausen give a lecture and Luciano Berio. And Delia Derbyshire was familiar with Pierre Schaeffer and Pierre Henry and these concrete techniques, which we possibly know more generally now as radiophonic techniques, perhaps, and the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, which Delia Derbyshire was a big part of, and she engineered the Doctor Who soundtrack, which is, you know, perhaps her most famous export. And so Paul McCartney was kind of aware of her as well, and he said anything that was modern coming out of the BBC was usually her. So he looked her up in the phone book and he went to see her, and hilariously she didn't even come to the door. He was just told that she was in her shed at the bottom of the garden. So he went to see her, and she had these tape machines set up, and she, you know, reel-to-reel tape machines, and she was working to create tape loops and running these tape loops around the machines and watching how they might glitch or, you know, like I say, being able to kind of speed them up and slow them down, play them backwards, and coming up with all these psychedelic effects in music, which is a very subversive sound. You know, you're taking you're taking an original sound, perhaps, like I say, it's the sound of somebody laughing or a brass band playing or something, and then you speed it up or you flip it, you play it backwards, you're subverting its meaning. It's kind of, it's a subversive act. And that was very, you know, in keeping with kind of the countercultural forces at the time. And it obviously chimed with Paul McCartney. And he went and got two of his own Brenel tape machines and started doing the same thing. And he talks about taking a bag full. He told me he had like a plastic bag full of tape loops that he took to Abbey Road. And he said they were just all kinds of sounds that he taped at home. You know, the sounds of... the sounds of birds, the sounds of members of the band laughing. He told me at one point they asked the engineers to just go around and kind of bang on things around the studio and then add echo effects or, you know, record it onto a tape, create a loop and then, you know, speed it up or slow it right down so that it's all kind of echoey and drawn out. And there's a lot of those things that you hear in Tomorrow Never Knows. He said it was already like a far out song.
I think just in case people aren't familiar with it, and I hope they're not, I hope they're hearing it now for the first time, this is Tomorrow Never Knows. It's the Beatles. That's the Beatles and Tomorrow Never Knows. Is it true, and I think you mentioned it in the book, that McCartney at one stage was talking to Delia Derbyshire about trying to create a soundscape for Yesterday?
He was, yes. He wanted an entirely electronic arrangement of Yesterday, and that's what he originally went to see her about. And then he just said they never got around to it. I have since been told that she did do an electronic remix of Yesterday that's in her archive. So hopefully that will see the light of day one, you know, at some point, and he might get to hear it.
There are a number of albums in the book that kind of resurface from time to time as seminal works that influenced a lot of other artists. And one of those is Wendy Carlos's Switched on Bach. Why is that so important?
Yeah, well, she was working with Bob Moog, as I kept being told is the correct pronunciation. We always say Moog here, incorrectly. Yeah, Bob Moog, who developed the Moog synthesizer. And the synthesizer, Bob Moog, he'd been kind of building on theremin technology. So he started the Moog Empire selling home-built theremin kits and working with oscillators and electromagnetic fields. And then that developed into the synthesizer over time, over about 10 years, to almost as we know it today. But it was, there were lots of like wires and it was a really kind of cumbersome bit of kit. But Wendy Carlos was somebody who works with Bob Moog to really develop that instrument to become central to a performance. You know, these electronic instruments like the theremin and early synthesizers had mostly been used for kind of spooky sound effects and background, you know, weird and wonderful kind of spacey sounds in film soundtracks and scores and things like that. And she wanted to play Bach on it, and she thought that Bach's music was timeless enough to be reimagined in this way, and she worked with him to kind of create an instrument, and you know, they added a keyboard, which was kind of controversial at the time because avant-gardists wanted the synthesizer to be in much more of a kind of microtonal, weird and wonderful instrument that could create these weird and wonderful sounds to reflect preoccupations and psychedelic pursuits of the time. But instead they added a keyboard and it, you know, made it much more user-friendly and took it to the kind of front of the stage, really.
I love that you mentioned in the book, and we're not really going to have time to talk about it much, but Isao Tomita's album Snowflakes Are Dancing from 1974,
yes,
inspired by that. If people haven't heard it, look it up on the streaming service of your choice. I do know Giorgio Moroder was also influenced by all of this. And this leads us then ultimately to Donna Summer's I Feel Love.
Yes. And I didn't know before I started researching this that she had been, that she'd moved to Austria. She'd been part of an Austrian opera company and sang opera and learnt German, married an Austrian man. And her name, Summer, was his Austrian name. It was like Sommer, but anglicised. And so she was in that part of the world. And Giorgio Moroder, he, before that track, before he'd kind of been working in dance music and disco music, he'd been working with synthesizers. In fact, the synthesizer, the Moog synthesizer that the Beatles had used. And he was making this, you know, I suppose, One of the people I interviewed for the book was Jean-Michel Jarre, who's a French, made stadium-filling dance music. And he was talking really interestingly about the difference between the French approach and the German approach. And he was saying that the French, as I was describing with Pierre-Henri and Pierre Schaffer, they were taping sounds and looping them and mixing them. And it was quite playful and fun and subversive and kind of thumbing the nose to the establishment. Whereas the Germans, they were going into the kind of studio, into the laboratory and engineering new sounds. And Stockhausen was a pioneer in this area. And so it was sort of spreading across Germany and the use of a new kind of synthesizer technology, new studio technology to just create new sounds from scratch. And Giorgio Moroder had been working in this tradition and he'd created some quite kind of unusual avant-garde music, solo records. And then he was put in touch with Donna Summer and her background in soul and gospel and his background in German electronica. And we have this like fantastic electronic dance tune with a motoric beat. And it's just this fantastic blending of like American disco and German and, you know, the German avant-garde influence.
I think after all of that, we need to hear a little bit of it. This is Donna Summer. Giorgio Moroder, Donna Summer's I Feel Love. If you're listening to Arena tonight while you're making your dinner in the kitchen, I hope that worked for you. We've already mentioned Elizabeth Dealey Derbyshire. We've mentioned Wendy Carlos. Pauline Oliveros was another innovator who was huge in redefining what we understood to be music. I mean, there are exceptions, but traditional classical music is mostly a male-dominated form. Why are there so many women innovators, do you think, when it came to electronic music?
Yeah, I think part of the reason was that these new kind of music making machines like synthesizers, tape machines, tape delay, all that kind of thing, they were allowing women a route into the industry. So they didn't have to, you know, be going to the same bars and moving in the same circles. They didn't need men to commission them to be able to, you know, work with their orchestra or get the funding through establishment organizations. So these gadgets just allowed women to kind of work in rooms alone and make sounds on their own and compose something from beginning to end and perform and record it. And Pauline Oliveros was one of those. Suzanne Ciani is another woman in the book who talks a lot about that. And she worked with the Buchla synthesizer, which was developed by Don Buchla on the West Coast, while Bob Moog was kind of making the Moog on the East Coast. It was kind of this... unprecedented routes into the industry, and they found an affinity. Women seem to find an affinity with it, often we talk about men working with technology, don't we? So I just think that's such a kind of fascinating subplot to the whole story of music technology. Really,
it is. Maybe just before we finish, I want to talk about one more seminal album that reappears throughout the book. It's Brian Eno's Ambient One, Music for Airports. It is a regular soundtrack when I'm driving my car anywhere. Why is that such an important album?
Well, Eno appears in the chapter that I also kind of profile John Cage, and also Steve Wright as well, actually. And the two of them talk, well, Steve Wright and Brian Eno talk about space appearing in music and this kind of sense of like the atmosphere in a room of music feeling as though it's happening while, you know, whilst you're listening to it in real time, or even if it's been recorded. I think that's kind of what Brian Eno was aiming for with that. Just this sense of it kind of this atomic level change of these tape loops moving, but in a way that kind of really incorporates the feeling and the ambience and the atmosphere of a room into the sound. And that gives you a sense that you're almost there.
Yeah,
it certainly has that, doesn't it? It's, you know, yeah, sorry, go
very
on.
Much so. No, it is an absolutely fascinating book and I enjoyed it thoroughly. Elizabeth Alker, thanks for joining us on Arena tonight.
Thank you for having me.
The book is Everything We Do Is Music, How 20th Century Classical Music Shaped Pop, and it's published by Faber. The Swallow is an Irish feature film written and directed by Tygo Sullivan, and it tells a quiet story about reflection. It stars Brenda Fricker as an elderly artist who lives a solitary life in the west of Ireland, surrounded by faded photographs, unfinished artworks and mementos. She writes a letter to an unknown recipient and reflects on the fleeting nature of memory, the impermanence of art and the relentless pull of time. And all the while, her solitary world is underscored by the constant sounds of the sea and encroaching waves. I'm delighted to be joined now by the director, Tygo O'Sullivan. Tyg, people will be familiar with your work from documentaries like To the Moon and The Great Wall, but this is your first drama feature. So why did you choose to make a drama for The Swallow?
It's a good question. I ask myself that frequently in the making of. It began as a documentary, or rather the idea for a documentary. I thought a film about the preservation of art and the politics of the preservation of art, like what do we choose to put in museums and how do we hope to treasure things on into a very uncertain future. I thought that was a really interesting subject for a film, if a little dry, and I thought it might be a little bit dull. Whereas if you could, the epiphany, I suppose, was the idea that if you could put these questions into the mind of somebody for whom they were very acute, that might be slightly more interesting and give the whole thing a human frame. So if you take, say, an artist who's in the winter of her life, living close to an ever-rising sea, surrounded by art, and that she wasn't sure what was going to become of it, then all of these questions suddenly take on a sort of a human frame and an importance and an urgency that a documentary simply couldn't capture.
Given that the process is obviously quite similar but quite different at the same time, how different is making a drama to making a documentary? Did you have to go through much of a learning curve?
Oh, totally. I mean, when you make a documentary, I've made I've shot any number of films where you turn up somewhere and you look around and go, oh, this is a nice room, and you get on with it. Whereas with a drama, you turn up into an empty room and somebody's asking you what color you want the curtains to be. It's, you're creating a world from scratch, where documentary is responding to a world. But I was lucky enough to fall in with some really remarkable people who could guide me through that. No better person than the wonderful Tim Devine, who we've since lost. Tim was brilliant at taking this house that we'd found and turning it into a house that was believably the home of an elderly artist who had perhaps never lived anywhere else. So it had a kind of depth of living, a kind of a timelessness to it. And he transformed the space into that so that I could then, I suppose, tune into my documentary skills and kind of almost shoot like a documentary in this created world, if you know.
How do you begin that process? Because obviously as a documentary maker, production design, it isn't really your sort of thing. How do you start finding the house and creating the location and then filling it with all of that life and clutter? What was the first move is presumably to find the perfect location.
Yeah, and I engaged a locations person who I think I really annoyed him. I gave him a brief of finding a house close to the sea, not too fancy, not too shiny, anywhere between Donegal and West Cork.
That's a broad brief.
It's a pretty broad brief. And any time he came back, I was like, no, I was a bit Goldilocks about the whole thing. And eventually, just through my own social circles here in North Clare, I was made aware of a house that is literally on the sea with a tidal pool that comes up and almost inundates it every month. And it had the added benefit of being about half an hour from where I lived. So I approached the people who live there and secured that. So finding the place, I mean, it's a bit like casting, and we'll get on to the casting of the film, I'm sure, but casting the house was almost as important as casting the people. But once they had that space and had it cleared and then worked with Tim in creating this world, you kind of have a lot of the film is ready there to bring the people into, you know.
How did that relationship work between yourself and the late designer, Tim Devine? Was he somebody who came to you with a number of ideas and left you to make all of the choices, or did he come to you with ideas fully formed?
We talked a lot. You know, we got to know each other very quickly and very well, because, you know, the nature of collaborating on art is that you sit around talking about what you find beautiful, which is a quick way to get close to somebody. And Tim was brilliant at listening, but he was, you know, he's very businesslike. He was a serious professional. He'd just come off the Banshees of Inisherin at the time. So he wasn't hanging around, but he would send me sketches, send me drawings, really beautiful drawings and photographs of the sculptor Louise Bourgeois. Like photographs of her in her studio saying something like this, and I was like, absolutely. So it was that kind of mood board almost approach, and that's all fine in theory, but then he would put that into practice by jumping in a van or and driving to Athenry to an antiques shop and sending me photographs of paintings and chairs and curtains and whatnot, until we had the stuff and clutter of the house.
Let's take a clip from the film before we go any further. This is Brenda Fricker as the elderly artist writing a letter to an unknown correspondent and reflecting on her life and memories.
I wrote to you about my endless hours walking this ever-changing shore, watching the patterns and the play of light and the shapes of water, the colours around the clouds. I wrote how I would gather up a few of these, take them home with me. Small moments at a time, kept so they wouldn't be lost.
Now that we've heard Brenda Fricker, let's get to the casting. How did that happen?
I don't know if you remember. I think a lot of listeners might remember Brenda being on the Tommy Tiernan show a couple of years ago. And that was when I'd written the film. I'd had it funded happily through the Arts Council, but I hadn't cast it yet. And watching Brenda talk about living alone, her battles with depression, I mean, it became my partner kind of whacked me on the arm and pointed at her and said, you need her, which I would never have presumed to do. But with a bit of encouragement, I was able to get in touch with her through Maureen Hughes, the casting director. And Brenda, I think, liked the sound of what I was trying to do. And we sat down and had a chat about the project, about her role in it. And we kind of took it from there.
Because it's not an ordinary role, really, in terms of everything that we see that happens on screen is her. It's entirely visual. And then pretty much all of her comes through the voiceover that is then comes later on. It's a slightly different role.
Yeah. And I think Brenda was intrigued by that. You know, the idea of being on your own, you know, as the only character in a film was maybe something that was interesting to her. It was a different kind of character to, you know, Brenda's cast a lot as over her career as a mother, as a grandmother, that kind of thing. So being a solitary person, a bit drawing quite a bit, I suppose, on her own life, her own experience, somebody who lives on her own. This was intriguing and interesting to her. And it meant for me, of course, that she could bring a huge amount of experience to and really flesh out this kind of sketched out idea for a character that I had.
Is it true that you had shot the film before you actually wrote the script?
Kind of like the film, like going back to what we were saying earlier about kind of using my documentary skills, a lot of the scenes were improvised. You know, you're dealing with the North Clare weather. You're kind of working with what light there is, what rain there is very often, what the sea is doing on a given day, what kind of mood people were in. So we improvised an awful lot around the house. There was a number of scenes that were kind of important to the film, and those were kind of, I made sure to get those, but then we'd improvise certain things. I had a rough outline of what the text, the letter that we hear, a rough idea of what that was going to be, the kind of subjects that would be explored within it, the tone of it, but I didn't write it or certainly not record any version of it until the film was more or less assembled. I just found that if you had a text and you then went to shoot a film to go with it, you'd end up relying on the text and kind of hanging the images on the words. Whereas the challenge to me was to make the film, the visual sonic aspect of the film, really work on its own terms first and then add the other layer. I thought that was possibly the best route to go.
You know, the text in the film, it's quite sparse, it's quite meditative, there are long gaps in between. It also helps to create atmosphere.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked with text in film a lot in the past. My film, The Great Wall, about borders and walls around Europe, used a Kafka short story as the kind of narration to the moon. My film about the moon had a lot of poetry and excerpts from old movies in it. So this idea of words and pictures kind of coming together to create meaning is I suppose, is what I do. And my big learning from previous experience is that there's only so many words that an audience can take in when it's a text, basically. Mm. So I tried to minimize that and really shrink it down to what was necessary.
And in terms of the actual recording of the voiceover, that happened at a much later stage.
Yeah, the film was more or less done. Like I edited, I would record, I would write and then record my own voice reading. Nobody ever got to see that or listen to it, God forbid. But just for my own understanding that the film was working. And then when it was finished, I went to Brenda and I wanted her to see the film for the first time and record the voiceover on the same day so that she would sort of have a very visceral kind of response to the imagery and the film in mind when she performed the voiceover. And that seems to have worked.
And you didn't go to a studio, you recorded it in her house?
Yeah, I know. I mean, you couldn't be dragging people around. No, I mean, Brenda's been a wonderful collaborator on this film, so kind of work in the way that best suits her and how she's most comfortable.
You alluded to the soundscape earlier on. It is very complicated. It is very evocative. There's music involved. There are archive extracts. There's the sound of the sea. Maybe just talk to me a little bit about how all that came together.
Yeah, if anybody who's ever spent time on their own in the countryside will realize that you've got various registers of sound going on. You kind of tune in and out of them. The sounds of nature, the sound of the wind and rain, and just the general sounds of a house. And then you've got your own sounds, be that the radio, the sounds inside your head. So for me, it was just about gathering up enough of those sources that I could, almost like a painting, kind of build these things up in layers. I work with on the shoot with a brilliant sound recordist called Bob Brennan. He and I have worked together a lot over the years. He's brilliant not only at recording the dialogue aspect or the close sync sound of a film, but also the atmospheric ambient sound of a world. And then I also spent a lot of time, because the budget of the film was so small, I ended up clearing out the house on my own at the end, which was I grumbled about a lot at the time, but it meant that I was driving over and back to the location, and I would always bring the camera and I'd always bring the microphones so that I would leave like a microphone running down on the shore while I loaded up the car, and I would end up with these beautiful recordings of curlews and oyster catchers and things like that that required a lot of patience to gather. And then I'd also have the camera with me. So there's quite a few shots in the film that were nabbed when the light was just so in that kind of way.
Just to finish, Tadhg, you said that you wanted to explore the preservation of art in this film. When you look at it now, what do you think its message is to people who see it?
I suppose the film is framed as a series of questions. I mean, I think that's the key thing, going back to the documentary versus drama. Documentary tends to have to present answers, whereas fiction can get away with presenting questions. I think there's a lot of important questions, I hope, in the film about what do we preserve in the face of a rising sea and an uncertain future. I think the key thing that I take away is just to recognize the need to pass things on to the next generation and not to worry about the long, long term, which is something that is impossible to think about, but just to hold things on for at least one generation and to entrust and believe in the next generation to look after art, but also the world.
Tadhg O'Sullivan, thank you very much for talking to us tonight on Arena. Tadhg's latest film, The Swallow, is now at selected cinemas nationwide. And you're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. A truly monumental photography exhibition is happening at the Royal Hibernian Academy in Dublin currently. Archipelago is a group photography show on a scale seldom seen in this country, as 17 international photographers have taken over the vast space of the Ashford Gallery. Photographer Conor Horgan and RHA curator Davy Moore are with me now in studio. We've already posted some of the images that we are going to be talking about on the Arena Instagram, if you want to check that out at the same time. Conor, you're a member of the Island Photographers Group. So who is that group? And maybe tell us a little bit about how the exhibition came about in the first place.
So the Island Photographers Group is a group, a very informal kind of voluntary group that came together a couple of years ago with the express purpose of raising the profile of contemporary art photography in this country. We felt that this is something that absolutely needed to happen, needed to be done. And of course, like any group that comes together, we talked about, well, we could do this, we could do that, we could do the other. And then somebody had the great idea of we could start building a community. So that's exactly what we did. And for the last number of years, we've had talks where we've partnered with all of the major institutions, with librarians, with archivists, with collectors. We've conducted public interviews with people, and a lot of artists, practitioners from all over the country have come together to share their work. So we're really building this community in the hope that that will help build the profile of art photography in this country, and it certainly seems to be doing so, very much so with this show. I love that you used the word monumental. That's how we feel about it. In fact, one of the other Island photographers said to me the day afterwards, she said she teaches as well, and she said that her students had come up to her at the opening, which was absolutely rocking, I can tell you, and with their eyes wide open said they hadn't realised that you could present photography at such a scale and with such ambition in this country. So when we heard that, we thought, we're definitely doing something right.
I am going to ask you about that opening, but I want to ask you something else first. Why do you think the profile of photography like this in Ireland needs to be raised, or why do you think it hasn't been prior to this point?
Well, we were talking about this outside, and there's a longer version which goes into post-colonialism, which I'm afraid we don't have time for.
But is there a potted version of that? I'm interested.
Well, I think, you know, like the visual arts in general in this country have never been truly valued, because for so many years, you know, when you have things like William Orpen, who was the greatest portrait painter of his day, had to move to London to make a living. So everything was always very London-centred. And when London left the picture, we were left behind, and we were left with music and with literature, but the visual arts were kind of always a little bit further down the pole. So I think they are making their presence felt more and more, and we're doing our best to make that happen.
Tell me about the opening night. I've been asked to ask you specifically about that because it was, I was told, quite raucous.
It was absolutely rocking. There was at least 750 people there. I had friends texting me in the middle saying, are you here? They couldn't find me. There were people from 4 years old to 90. And certainly the only RHA opening I've ever been at that at 20 past eight in the evening, they started turning the lights out to try and get us to leave.
The old trick. I there was definitely a lot of people there that I didn't meet. I just didn't see, and I was around the whole night. So that is quite unusual now, that has to be said. It was amazing.
Davy, the sheer scale and the range of the work are the first things that hit you when you walk into the gallery. How would you describe it? In a sense, you're giving us a very broad sweep of what's going on in contemporary photography.
Yeah, that's it. So I wanted, as you say, when you walked into the gallery, that you were kind of enveloped in it. And as you walked through, that kind of envelopment kind of stayed with you. When I got this show, the space, the Gallagher Gallery, which is Gallery 1 in the RHA, it's a massive space. It's quite daunting. And this is my first big show there. So I was just as daunted as Conor and the rest were. And I wanted to use the space. It's very rare that you see stuff high on those walls. So I wanted to go up the walls, out onto the floor. A lot of the work kind of follows the idea of expanded practice, which in photography is really kind of taken off in recent years. So people are using more sculptural forms in installation. There's a lot of, as well, there's a lot of vinyl in the show. Conor used vinyl. And, you know, just you can use that for large scale images. But people really kind of, there's not that many straight lines, you know, of images. And so when you walk in, you're never far from something, you know. So that was my intention with the show, and also it's kind of in a thematic sense, so that neighbor to neighbor, you were following a kind of a path. Now there was also obviously conversations going on across the room. Actually, I have my when I first started this process, I'll try and describe this then for radio.
I can describe it for here. It's one of the most complex diagrams I've seen in quite some time.
And it was basically, I got the island guys were on board, and I wanted to kind of mapped out what they were doing thematically, and then looking at what else was happening and trying to kind of broaden out, match up, broaden out. I wanted to touch on LGBTQ plus stuff, on expanded form, abstraction, psychic landscapes. And there was, to kind of add to what was happening there, we've got stuff on nature and science, gender issues, a lot about borders, which we're going to be talking about with Connor now. I wanted it to be a kind of overwhelming experience almost when you walked in.
Connor, what sort of themes are on display here? Have those themes changed over the years?
Well, I think this is a great overview on what is exciting and interesting, a key selection of Irish contemporary photographers. So that's what you see in the show. And I think Borders has always been kind of a part of Irish photography, going to the border. And certainly that is reflected in the work of Kate Nolan, who's next door to me. And then my work is largely about the fences that were put up along the canal against the asylum seekers last year. So there was various kilometres of fences put up ostensibly to protect the amenities of the canal from these men who had come to this country seeking protection, and by putting up these fences and these physical borders along the canal that made them more susceptible to being attacked and being harassed by members of anti-immigrant groups and so on. So, these are still live issues. It's not all kind of chocolate, or actually none of it is chocolate boxy, you could say. It's all got to do with something. It all means something if you go in there. And I loved what Davey said about feeling overwhelmed, because when you walk in, the room is crackling with energy. There's all these different competing approaches, and you see the range of how different practitioners are bringing their work to that big, big room. And it's not necessarily a competition, but there's a very loud symphony going on.
And I think it is worth saying, because it does sound like your work is quite, could be good narrative, documentary style. It isn't at all. It's just visually to describe it. It is a ginormous image of one of these railings on the wall. And then over that is a kind of collage of other images you took, which were done over the course of about a year and a half, and then on the floor there is, coming out onto the floor, there's an image of where a tent had been on grass, and it almost looks kind of sepulchral, grave-like. And I have been describing it to people, it's very visually striking, that the whole thing, and it is, and I don't mean this in any kind of bad way, and I know you won't take it that way, but it's actually quite ugly, but it's kind of overwhelmingly, it has that effect. I mean, these things were ugly.
As the fences were ugly, the fences were a form of visual pollution, so I wanted people to be overwhelmed by that installation, but then go in and start discovering some of the smaller images.
I should say, the individual images are far from ugly.
And it was very key as well not to have people in them, because to have identifiable people as asylum seekers actually exposes them to danger.
An issue.
So the work is very much semi-abstracted, and it's my own emotional response to what the situation was.
And again, if people want to see, we've taken Edge, I think, which is one of the works, and that's up on the Instagram. Not the same as seeing it at the exhibition, but that's where, if people want to have a look at it now. Davey, Brian Sparks is one of the photographers. Talk to me about his piece, Backup. Maybe describe it first. Tell us a little bit about Brian and the kind of work he makes.
Absolutely. So Brian, I should probably give you a bit of a background on Brian. He's a kind of I would call him a photo book expert. Photo books are a large part of the way photographers show their work now. And I would say even with the Brian's probably more into photo book than even exhibiting. But the way that he's done his works are, we have beveled walls in the corners of this gallery, so they're at a 45 degree angle, and he's used those. It's about a, you know, metre and a half and a metre and a half either side. He's done a grid, so there's 27 images, which, as you were saying, Connor, is a full show, a full large show. Mm. 27 images in a grid, so you kind of have your kind of sweet spot that you can stand in, and you can get that the whole range of them there. And he kind of did this. He's very interested in motifs, Brian, I would say, and he does a thing, to give him a little plug. He does a thing which is amazing, which everyone should check out, called Photo Book Combos on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And he's an incredible photo book collection. And he might take a book from, I don't know, like the Deep South in America, and compare it to one that somebody had done on the Irish West. And he will take 10 images from each, and he'll do comparisons, really. And they're beautiful. And so he's very interested in his own work, and and it's actually interesting because, you know, Connor, talking about immigration, Breen has moved a lot. I think he's lived in maybe four or five different countries, and his work is informed by that moving and being kind of, you know, feeling at home anywhere. And actually, that's obviously what, you know, the people in Connor's, not the people, but the what Connor's work is about is the opposite. And, you know, Breen's work is more about the way that it should be.
Yeah. Connor, Kate Nolan is looking at the impact of partition on young people. The series is called Lacuna. She chose three locations to take the photographs.
Yes, there was, I think, Pettigo is one of the main centres, which is a village on the border. And that is a substantial body of work, which she's been working on since 2016. We saw earlier versions of it in the Museum of Photography and in the Irish Cultural Centre in Paris. And again, she has gone very deep into these kind of echoes of borders, or the ghosts of borders that used to be. And Davy has placed that echo beside the absolute hard steel reality of mine, and then the kind of more dreamlike version of Brian slightly down the wall. So again, it's quite exciting for us to go in and see how these works all start speaking to each other.
Yeah, I was going to ask Davy about Ciara Richardson's work as well. I want to make sure we find out about that.
Absolutely. I just say quickly on Kate's, you know, Kate definitely used, as Connor did, the height of the space for it very well. And she also, you know, she had these plinths made, which were, I was thinking about it today, they remind me of the towers, you know, these towers that they used to have along the border. So these are, you know, 6 foot tall plinths, which is very unusual. Her work is called Lacuna, and it's about children's perceptions of the border now, and in a sense that lacuna, that's something missing. They don't see it in the same way that we do. Grew up every day we heard about murders on the news. Whereas the kids that she was working with, and she worked with them for about two years, it just, for them, they kind of see that as crazy. I mean, they can't understand it. But Ciara's work, Ciara Richardson, is looking at the male gaze, and they're very interesting. They're, I suppose, what you'd call dynamic works.
Kinetic,
yes. Okay. So she's as much an kind of engineer as she is an artist. She's a recent graduate. She graduated from TU Dublin just last year. So it is quite important to say this is an intergenerational show. And, you know, so you've got Ciara right the way up. And she created new works for this too. So to kind of physically describe them, there are images that she got from, I think it was the Met, and they're of male forms, sculptural male forms. And she has then created another layer over this, which when you pull strings, reveals a kind of a shape, a kind of geometric shape, which has women's eyes on it. Mm. And so it's a nice play on the male gaze. And it's really fun to play. So,
Connor, before we finish up, Island Photographers, you have a book coming out next month. Tell me about that.
We do. This is something, again, that our member Brian Sparks started doing, these fantastic Instagram reels where he would just pick a whole bunch of photographs from Irish photographers' Instagram accounts and then put them together in themed reels. And we thought, these are fabulous. We love them. Let's do that on the printed page. So we have our very first publication coming out. The launch is going to be on the 23rd of October. There are 40 Irish photographers represented in it. Already we've just heard in the last couple of days that it's going to be sold at Paris Photo, which is the spring show for international art photography, and at various other festivals, including the big one in Portsmouth that Martin Parr is, or sorry, in Bristol that Martin Parr is very central to. So we're getting Irish photography out there, not only with this exhibition, but also with this book.
And after this, where does Irish photography go from here, if you have your say?
I mean, what can I say? Onwards and upwards. I mean, we would love to have a centre for photography in this country that is run by and services photographers to kind of go along with the existing institutions, because there is obviously a need for representing the community of Irish art photographers in this country, and we're going to do our best to do that.
The Island Photographers Institution?
Whatever you want to call it. That's all sounds good to me.
It's been lovely to talk to you both. Thank you for joining me tonight. Thanks. Archipelago runs at the RHA in Dublin until the 26th of October.
Actually, and could I just say, we're actually, we felt that the show was such a huge hit that we're actually extending it until Christmas.
You heard it here first. It runs all the way through until Christmas at rhagallery.ie. That's where you will find the information. Conor Horgan, photographer and RHA curator, Davey Moore, thanks for talking to us tonight on Arena.
Thanks so much.
That's it from us. Sean O'Gorman produced tonight. Research was by Paula Shields. Our broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton, and it was Niall McMonagall on sound supervision. I'm Rick O'Shea, and I'll talk to you again tomorrow night from 7 o'clock. John Creedon is next.